Welcome to Gola. I'm Katie Parla, a Rome-based food and beverage writer, culinary guide, and New York Times bestselling cookbook author.
And I'm Danielle Caligari, assistant professor of Italian at Dartmouth College and writer at large for Tuscany and the Italian South at Wine Enthusiast.
Oh, hey, Danielle, what's going on?
Oh, hi, Katie. Didn't see you there.
That's so weird.
I am, of course, in Hanover, New Hampshire, recording from Dartmouth College, this episode of Gola, the podcast dedicated to Italian food and beverage. And Katie, you are in the Caput Mundi, city that I love dearly and where I wish I could be with you right now. But luckily, we have this virtual opportunity to record. And we are returning to some of our favorite, most essential conversations because we're excited to welcome some new listeners and especially new patrons, and to return to the subjects we spend a lot of time with and update ourselves and our longer time listeners on some of the things that we have thought about more subtly over the last several years now that we've been friends and co-hosts for years. So, Katie, what do you want to talk about today?
This is a favorite topic of mine. I get a lot of cues about this subject, and it's actually kind of two subjects. It's pasta and condimenti, pasta, shapes, and sauces. It's the subject even of like a whole entire book by Oretta Zanini De Vita and Maureen Fant. And it sounds like something that shouldn't have a whole sort of science or pseudoscience behind it. But here in Italy, it sure does. There are rules and regulations. I've gotten a lot of really great feedback about our rules episode, aka how not to humiliate yourself in Italy or to be shamed by Italians for asking for something that they don't understand. And this is...
Yeah, we did. I have to say, I think that might be everybody's favorite from last season. I hear about it all the time, people listening and then re-listening as they are like walking to a dinner in Italy somewhere, which is incredible. Sweet. I do think that the conclusion of that episode was there actually are no rules. You just have to be Italian. But
yeah, the enforcement's a little irregular. But in any event, go back and listen to the rules episode. It's great. And I want to sort of tell a little story. I love to go to this place called Cesare al Casaletto. It's a fantastic trattoria. I write about it all the time. I gram from there all the time. You're probably familiar if you're listening. And they have a pasta shapes and sauces list where you can mix and match. So, for example, you can choose from bombolotti or spaghetti or tonnarelli, ravioli, gnocchi. And then the list of sauces is like cacio e pepe, carbonara, gricia, sugo di coda, etc. However, if you order carbonara and gnocchi or carbonara and ravioli, you'll just be told no.
No. Right.
No. Non si fa. Non c'entra un cazzo quel condimento con quella pasta, scusa. But of course, in not with vulgar words like I've just used, but
right.
a glare. So what is driving the sort of propriety rules and regulations about which pasta sauces go with what where? I mean, let's just get into it.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is a place where I can probably justify taking a slightly deep historical dive, because if only to undermine the suggestion that rules are as rigid as some people, Italians and certainly also plenty of people outside of Italy would try to have you believe. Pasta, we have established this. And again, in this kind of would-be back to basics mini series here, we are talking about things that we've talked about before in earnest. So naturally, there are plenty of other episodes where we talk a lot about pasta. There are dedicated pasta episodes. Please become a patron and go back to them. You'll hear us being a little bit less well-edited and certainly with poorer quality audio, but probably more fun also, to be honest. So, we have at length underlined that the relationship with pasta that we understand now as part of pop culture, particularly in a kind of globalized economy, seen from beyond the peninsula, within the peninsula, is not at all the relationship that has historically been what Italians develop with pasta. In fact, for most of recorded culinary history, people on what is the Italian peninsula, what is today Italy, were not eating pasta. They certainly weren't eating durum wheat pasta. And when they did begin to eat pasta, they ate usually long sheets of it in something akin to a lasagna preparation, and or a soup with pieces of pasta in various shapes and sizes, and usually not particularly regular forms, for most of history up until the late 19th century. And frankly, even we can stretch that even to the mid 20th century after World War II into what is called the economic boom and the moment when Italians were able to have the financial wherewithal to open their diets to non-strictly immediately available and highest calorie content for cost of food available to them. So that's a real fast and dense summary of the fact that pasta is actually, in the grand scheme, a relatively new introduction to the everyday diet of Italians. So any rules we talk about are also pretty new. And if you want to get into a fight about it, by all means do. But at the end of the day, your server at Cesare is still not giving you gnocchi with carbonara. So that's to right. Your point, Katie, where do we start with what is or isn't acceptable to, in your mind? What's a good starting point, leaving behind then that longer history as a backdrop for us?
Well, I mean, I'm going to start in South Central Italy, where I live, the place where dried pasta made from durum wheat dough, extruded ideally through bronze dye, sometimes through Teflon, is dried. This is a technique that originates around the Bay of Naples. It's especially focused in Gragnano. And it's this style of dried pasta that has spread all over Italy and all over the world, promoted partially by the fascist need to provide calories for people and to create a diet that is based around a concept of Italian identity. So interestingly, like coffee, pasta is something that is so inextricably linked to Italian identity, is something that is consumed daily, if not almost daily, and yet is a rather new arrival in most of the regions. So when I'm thinking about my favorite shapes, which tend to be the long strands like spaghettoni or spaghetti, I'm thinking of things with a lot of like sauce and oil. Carbonara with spaghetti is great. Aglio e peperoncino with spaghetti is great. A like oil slicked garlicky pasta con le vongole is amazing. But then if you're thinking about long strands elsewhere, like tagliatelle around Bologna, then there's a whole different approach. You have not like oily slick sauces, you've got chunky, meaty sauces. And if not chunky with meat, then chunky with like lots of vegetables, things that are going to kind of simmer down into almost like a sticky condiment and stick to those nests of dried pasta, or rather of fresh pasta. Yeah. I mean, there's so many rules. I like get overwhelmed. And then still staying in, you are so much better at explaining these rules than I am. I will just add that soups, usually chunkier soups, are great with little stubby pasta shapes like ditali or like lumachine, those types of tiny things. And soup is something that doesn't get a lot of play in sort of the fame of Italian food culture, but is very, very prevalent, especially in the cooler seasons. It's something that is on home tables very frequently, less frequently in a restaurant or trattoria setting. But think of like little bits of pasta that would mingle with beans or chickpeas and be more or less the same size as those ingredients, or like a roughly chopped carrot or celery type sitch.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great both introduction and honestly getting towards a roundup already, at least in terms of creating some umbrella rules for us. You mentioned the fact that we have the big distinction of pasta that is dried, mostly being associated with the South, and pasta that is fresh, mostly being associated with the North. These are really big generalizations in terms of what's actually being served, especially right now. But that those traditions affect what is likely to be a pairing that you will find in those areas, and that because of that then becomes further entrenched. So if we use the example of spaghetti alle vongole, spaghetti with clams, you have a dried long pasta that's paired with a condiment, a sauce that is, as you mentioned, Katie, a perfect complement to long pasta that can get covered in what is ultimately a loose but delicate coating, and have the opportunity to kind of deliver that flavor in multiple moments across your palate as a result of the shape of the pasta. I think it's worth taking a half step back here to make a note about the fact that the dried pasta to fresh pasta distinction, like the long pasta to short pasta, or frankly, any other shape, is not necessarily associated with quality in any particular direction. I think that Americans, and I'm not sure, maybe you have some insight on this, I'm not sure entirely why Americans think that fresh pasta is inherently better, other than I suppose that they don't understand that good dried pasta can also be made fresh in the sort of immediate past of that day or a day or two before for drying purposes, and then allowed to dry and served that way.
It's partially because a lot of the dried pasta companies that have been present in the market, including some that were pioneered by Italian Americans based on the East Coast, have really used shit ingredients and fast drying techniques, which produces a gross pasta when you cook it. Whereas, you know, when we're talking about the high quality durum wheat slow dried pasta brands like Benedetto Cavalieri or Faello or Setaro, like that's a different ballgame. You can't put that mm-hmm. next to Barilla or even DiCecco in a taste test and expect a pasta that's made with such extreme care to not obliterate the one that's made as quickly and cheaply as possible. And, you know, in a way, it's not our fault. People have been taking advantage of Americans for a long time, and we have a system of food importation and distribution and a vertical integration in supermarkets that doesn't favor artisanal food production. Now, I think that there is a lot of regional tribalism in Italy. So if you're from Bologna, you tell yourself and you are told by others that the fresh pasta of Bologna is superior to all other pastas. I mean, I love a tortellone. I'll eat tortellini, but I would never give up spaghetti, not in a gazillion years. Never. So
I love how this sounds like somebody is trying to stop you from eating spaghetti.
I feel like any minute now someone is going to intervene and say you have to choose one pasta, and then I will not miss the other pastas because I will be so happy twirling my spaghetti as I stab pieces of guanciale and twirl it into a nest.
Okay, so I'm putting a pin in that. We are going to come back to Desert Island pasta condiment pairings, the Last Supper iterations, what you would choose. But before we get to our deathbed confessionals plus pasta, we should talk about the other options in terms of the kind of like the kind of large scale areas of pasta styles. We have long and short for sure, and we have dried and fresh. But we also have, as you mentioned, in the tortellini tortelloni world, stuffed pastas. And stuffed pastas are very familiar to American audiences, not only because of Italian ravioli, but also because the concept of filling a piece of dough and sealing it up is truly universal, the dumpling in its many forms. So it's, I think, one of the pastas that people are not only likely to have a kind of long relationship with, but probably feel pretty comfortable with, because you can get decent quality ravioli or adjacent stuffed pastas like tortelloni, et cetera. Not only fresh made, but also flash frozen and in a variety of other kind of pre-packaged quick prep forms. But I don't think that there's a lot of sensitivity to how those should be served, because I see stuffed pastas in America in particular getting obliterated with heavy sauces. And I worry for the consumer.
Yeah. I mean, when it depends also on what the filling is. Here, if you're having like cappelletti or tortellini, where the filling is like a really delicious blend of different meats that have been simmered in broth and are so flavorful, you don't want to put anything overpowering on that. So you would have your tortellini in a clear, delicate broth, or if you're being decadent, a delicate cream sauce, which is very typical around Modena and Bologna. Whereas if you're having a tortellone that's stuffed with, let's say, pureed pumpkin, you don't want to cover that up with tomato. So you want to have a delicious sauce made from butter and herbs that accentuates the flavor, almost seasons the filling rather than obscuring it. And you can get away, you know, with a tomato sauce if you have a ricotta filling. Although if you have really good ricotta, the odds are, if you're almost anywhere on the planet, unfortunately you don't. But if you've got a spectacular ricotta, then you could do the butter and herb, or like a super, super light tomato sauce. But if it's just like an average ricotta, you can get a little bit more intense with your condiments. Also, if you have a really good ricotta, don't cook it. Just eat it.
Yeah,
I was about to say,
my good Sicilian ricotta never makes it anywhere outside of the basket before it gets in my mouth. Yeah. So
scoop it out. Dump out the ricotta from your ravioli if you're even thinking about using the good stuff inside. Just use like the regular stuff inside. But that's sort of like the filled pasta category in the Emilia area, right? If you're in Sardinia and having like culordones, then you kind of want to use the filling as a guide for what you put on the outside, because some people stuff the culordones with a very garlicky potato filling. Some do a cheesy heavy potato filling with no garlic. Some people use herbs. So you kind of want to think about what is on the inside before even considering what you put on the outside.
Well, this brings us to the other large question I thought we should probably address here, which is the balance between, speaking of outside and inside, by which I mean to pivot us toward the amount of condiment to the amount of pasta. And I think this is another space where you hear people have apparently well-informed and very rigid, severe definitions of what's acceptable. And then if you look back historically, traditionally, or even at the contrast between kind of public and private, which is to say between a restaurant service and home service, you'll see very, very different expressions of this would-be rule. In fine dining establishments, particularly in the US, in Italian, what are technically Italian American, but what I think we perceive as truly Italian with square quotes around it, restaurants, we have places that really emphasize the quality of the pasta and a very, very light hand with the condiment, with the idea that the pasta is really the star and the whatever is on top of it should be a more subtle introduction. In long, you know, speaking of that long history we bounced back to at the top of the episode, we mentioned that most pastas were initially introduced into the Italian diet through baked or pasta al forno preparations and soup preparations, where in fact pasta was there for heft that wouldn't otherwise be present and a little bit of kind of texture and density, as opposed to really being the star of the dish in any way, in some ways even an afterthought. What is your experience now, Katie, looking at, you know, eating around Italy, mostly Rome, but also many other places, in terms of how people feel about eating their pasta and their sauces in restaurants or at home? What's happening, you think, on the ground, if we can go there?
I think that pretty much everyone is comfortable if after they've eaten their pasta, there's like half a slice of bread's worth of scarpetta sauce left behind, the sauce that's left over in the bowl that you clean with a little piece of bread. But the saucing is informed partially by an important technique called mantecatura, or the emulsification of the sauce, which helps bind it to the pasta. And whether you're, you know, at home or at a restaurant, the odds are that one of the components of your condimento is going to be the starchy pasta water, which is either added as the sauce is cooking or added with a little bit of the very al dente pasta to complete the cooking in the sauce. And there's this sort of physical agitation, like an almost like aggressive tossing of the pasta in the pan during this last stage of the cooking process that like causes the starch and whatever the lipid is. And if there's tomato, that too, and everything to kind of like bind together and then cling to the sauce. This is something you can use with the short stubby pasta shapes, bombolotti, candele, the longer tubes. It works with spaghetti. It works with a lot of the dried pastas. You want to be a little bit more gentle when you are dressing a stuffed pasta, because if you're like shaking it in the pan, the seams could burst open. You could sort of lose some of the filling into the sauce, and that's no bueno. But certainly with a lot of the dried pastas, the amount of sauce might be significant, but it's clinging to the pasta. It's sticking to the inside of a tubular shape and you know, the full 360 degrees of the other shapes.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect description that helps us also to get back toward an answer to the question of how do I figure out what pasta goes with what condiment. If we talk about it from the perspective of, okay, let's make a list of pasta shapes and acceptable things to put on them, it gets tricky. But as we've talked through this, I think we've come up with a series of kind of pieces of context that inform how you make that decision and hopefully will allow you to get an idea of what would be an appropriate pairing based on the texture and style of pasta, the sauce that's available, how it's going to be prepared and mixed together, as you point out, very importantly, what level of mantecatura there will be. And then I think the only last piece here we haven't discussed is, of course, the simple reality of what is available nearby. And in part, that's a kind of kilometro zero concept that is common to all Italian cooking, using things seasonally, using things regionally, considering how to make the most of what the land around you gives you naturally, and what is inexpensive and accessible all the time or at certain times accordingly. But that then sort of creates a cycle of expectation that people often, I think, not unfairly, but to some extent, not entirely, you know, with blinders on, to some extent, perceive as some kind of directive from above, so that the sauces that you are eating in Rome regularly, Katie, and I am whenever I get to be there, also indulging in, are paired with certain shapes of pasta, in part for all of the reasons, or according to the responses to the questions that we've asked already earlier, what was the pasta made of, when, how, what actual shape is it, but also in what kind of service and what is the texture, depth, and style of condiment, et cetera, et cetera. But also then simply, this is what we have available and this is what we've been doing for a long time. So we stick with it because we know it is good and satisfying.
Yeah. I mean, I think that this is what we do. This is what we've done for a while. So we're going to keep doing it is a very powerful guide for sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, before we say goodbye to the Golozi, we have to talk about a whole set of hand shapes from the South. I'm thinking like buziate from Trapani, which are great with pesto, great with the local pesto, which is a tomato and almond-based pesto. Orecchiette, which is fantastic little ear-shaped pastas from Puglia that are served with broccoli rabe. Definitely things like rascatelli from Basilicata that might be served with like a simple oil and garlic sauce and some pepperoni kruski. All the, you know, cicatelli and cavatelli varieties that you find all over Campania and Puglia that actually go well with a lot of different things, like a kind of brothy tomato sauce, even a meat sauce. And the Sardinians know what's up when it comes to pastas. There are probably more hand-shaped pastas that are actively made in Sardinia than any other part of the entire freaking world. So the Maluredus, which is basically like a ridged cavatelli, served with like sausage and tomato sauce there. It's delicious. And yeah, like the sort of tomato-based sauces that are cooked until the tomatoes really concentrated cling really well to the textured pastas like Loriguitas or Culergiones with that sort of pinched seam closure that looks almost like a stalk of wheat. What else? Should we just like name pastas and sauces so people can follow that guide? Because I feel like that's what I'm doing.
I think the list that you just gave us is a really good one in terms of how, not only because they're some of my favorite pasta shapes and they're absolutely friggin' delicious, but also because they bring us to that kind of last cherry on top point that I was getting toward anyway, I hope, with the question of what tradition dictates. Because they're representative, right? They're about identity and they're about doing something that takes time and effort, not because you have to anymore, because of course all of these shapes can be industrially made at this point, but also because any other kind of pasta could be obtained in order to have simply the presence of it on the table or the caloric intake if necessary. But people continue to make them because they feel close to them. They feel that those shapes bring out something about the place they are from and the people with whom they like to break bread in the metaphoric sense, and in this case, bite pasta. So I love looking at pasta shapes and condiment combinations because they are beautiful little jewels of representation, right? There, it's a plate full of who you think you are and what you want to show other people. And while I don't think we need to necessarily do a kind of telethon rolling list of pasta shapes and condiments, I did promise that we would come back to what the dish you would have pried out of your cold, dead hands would be. So why don't you give us, I'll let you have three if you need it. What would be your top three pasta condiment combos that you hope to never have to live without?
I mean, spaghettoni with clams all day. Bombolotti, which are like ridged little half rigatoni with sugo di calda. So like the very like sticky, rich sauce that oxtails have been cooked in Roman style. And this is so hard. I mean, the third one, this is so, so, so hard. Oh my God. What am I going to say? I can't even think of anything right now. I love the pasta styles of Sardinia so intensely. So probably, and I love the way that like Su Filandeu feels on the palate. It's kind of a luxury because it's hard to find souffolindeo outside of Sardinia. It's a three-layered lattice of hand-pulled durum wheat noodles that are incredibly thin, almost has like a velvety texture on the palate. It's cooked in mutton or lamb broth with an acidulated cheese. And there's this myth that it's like the most endangered pasta on the planet. It's fucking bullshit. You can find it everywhere in Sardinia now, thanks to a lot of people who've done a lot of work to keep it alive. So people need to stop writing that because they need to just start writing about the cool people who are making it. And I got real fiery and mad about that. but souffolindeo, definitely a cool soupy thing. I love melted cheese. I love like a velvety pasta flavor or texture, even though I'm usually into al dente things. This is an exception. So I'm going to, that's a really long-winded third answer. How about you?
No, that's not, I mean, it's first of all, I think worthwhile because those are dishes people really don't know about. And I'm a great appreciator of, actually great appreciator, I should say, the reason why we did this episode was in part because some listeners asked for us to do something within this vein, but also because you and I really love to talk about how many options there are that people have never heard of at all in this, under this umbrella of pasta, which feels like one of the most obvious, common, comfortable points of entry into talking about Italian food. So the long-winded answers from weird places and unheard of combinations are welcome, not only I'm sure by me, but also our Golosi listeners. What do I add to my list? Well, equally challenging, I would say. I was, of course, I gave myself the advantage by letting you talk while I thought about it. I will tell you that orecchiette with a leafy green, either in the, you know, cime di rapa or broccolini or broccoli rabe if you're in the US, plus a salsiccia is certainly in the top three there for me. I mean, the shape, orecchiette might be my favorite shape, just for texture and the way that it holds sauce. And, you know, speaking of how you come up with these pairings, it's just, you know, it's really the platonic ideal of pasta shape. I am also a really, really strong believer in the pasta con sarde preparations of in and around Palermo. There are a series of different iterations when it comes to the actual condiment. I think one of the things that's important for people who might know about this dish from Italian-American context is that several of the ingredients that we consider to be, or that I don't think we always reflect upon with care, are really important and not readily available in the US in general, but even in kind of specialty scenarios in major metropolitan areas in the US. So to make it, you really need a kind of wild baby fennel that is hard to find, and uvetta, which is raisins technically, but a kind that is smaller, a little bit sweeter, a little bit chewier, and again, native to the area of Sicily, but not readily available in the US. I hesitate to talk about the type of pasta because most of the time people use bucatini.
And
despite the distance between me and Katie right now, I'm still afraid of what violence might be visited upon me if I bring that up. But a long pasta, a spaghettoni works very nicely there as well. And even a long pasta with a wider hole is possible there, and there are a handful of iterations that are available, particularly when you're making pasta by hand. For my third, I think I might actually bring you joy in this case, Katie, by coming back to Rome. I may consider gricia to be my favorite simple condiment, and in that case, I would go with a classic rigatoni for that one. Yeah.
Disapprove of bucatini, approve of rigatoni.
Right, I know. So now we have once again let ourselves into the trap of becoming extremely, extremely hungry. And I am going to be punished because with the time difference, it is and my geographic location, it is highly unlikely that I'll be able to get rigatoni in any way, shape, or form for some time.
They don't serve rigatoni alla gricia at 9 a.m. in New Hampshire.
In New Hampshire. You know what?
Can I tell you a funny story about bucatini?
By all means, take us out with a funny story about bucatini, Katie.
Okay, so I'm editing Food of the Italian Islands. I get the layouts. I've got this dream. I want to have like big photo spreads throughout the book, but there's no room. I have too many recipes. So I've got to cut recipes. First one I cut, bucatini, pasta alla sarda bucatini style or whatever. Bucatini, right. With Lasarda. I don't even know what it's called anymore. I'm so tired. But I cut the bucatini recipe. That was the first one I cut. And now there's a beautiful spread in the pasta chapter.
I can't. I have to take some small offense, but then again, I'm sort of delighted by the fact that I can keep it to myself and eventually go to your house and see what you discarded for the general public and I get to keep forever in my heart.
I'm sad because I had to ditch also the like bechamel bound, ragu drenched little pasta rings. Au four. No. They're just there were like 500 fucking pasta recipes in this book. No one wants that. Because then people would say that they want it and they don't want it. And then I get the 4-star rating in the Amazon. I need the 5-star. So people learn about the book. It's like a whole thing. It's so stressful. But in any event, pretty soon you'll be able to pre-order that, baby.
Well, in addition to pre-ordering Food of the Italian Islands, which everyone should do immediately, they can find out a little bit more about pasta through a book you aided and abetted, one of the most famous internet pasta stars there is on. Isn't that right?
That's correct. Pasta Queen, more than 100 just gorgeous recipes, is coming out in November.
Well, we have so much to look forward to, not least more upcoming episodes of Gola on Deck. We look forward to hearing from you, and please become a patron whenever you can, because we are so excited to share more exclusive content with you. In the meantime, follow us. I'm at Dr. Caligari's Cabinet. Katie?
I'm at Katie Parla.
And you can find the podcast now at Gola_podcast. Arrivederci.
Ciao.